Well, hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. Thank you for joining me today. I say that every time, but I mean it. Glad you're on board with me. And I'm looking at the screen here. I got a whole bunch of callers, too, that have been waiting around for almost an hour. And so instead of jumping into some commentary at the moment, I think I will save thoughts that I have for a little later and maybe even for next week. But let me go to some of your callers. Now, I see a flashing light here. Does that mean you want me to go to that person? That person hasn't been on very long. I can go to whoever I want, right? Okay, so I'm going to go. What's that, three? Okay, Nathan. Okay, Nathan, you just got the vote here. You've been waiting for a long time, so thank you so much for your kindness and your patience.
Oh, no problem.
Thanks for taking my call. You're welcome.
So my question, so I'll explain a little bit first. I'm a student at a public university, and
uh-huh.
Most of my classmates are quite liberal, and I hear them a lot of the time making what I would consider to be kind of foolish statements about, you know, how wonderful socialism is or how terrible our country is. And mm-hmm. I want to push back and challenge them on this because I think some of those ideas are very harmful. But I hesitate to do that because I don't want to make an enemy over a political issue and then make that or have that cause me to miss a future opportunity to share the gospel with them. So I'm wondering if you have any advice on when is it worth pushing back and challenging people on issues outside of religion, and do you have any advice on how to do it?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if I have any good advice, but I have some thoughts. And this is a troublesome issue to face, and for a couple of reasons. For one, I know why you think that if you weigh in on what might be called a political issue, that you're going to get such resistance from the other side, such inappropriate resistance, or resistance in such an inappropriate way that they are going to judge you personally in view of your challenge, and therefore they will not listen to you on other issues, spiritual
exactly.
ones. Okay? And so that itself is an indicator of an environment that is a problem. Okay? So in a certain sense, what we have in the cultural debate right now is a bunch of bullies. I mean, I use the word advisedly. These are bullies. Now, I understand that there's a great movement to put down bullying, but the people who are characteristically part of that movement turn out to be the biggest bullies of all when it comes to other issues than their favorite things, or even if you go against their favorite things. And they will bully you relentlessly. So now you're thinking, gee, if I give them some reason to bully me, which itself is a problem, then how am I going to have an opportunity to speak on something more consequential than these political issues? And by the way, these political issues, ones that you raised, and many of them that are being discussed in the public square now, are not inconsequential issues. They are issues of great weight that have massive implications for all kinds of things in our culture, broadly for freedom and liberty. And for the freedom and liberty of being able to express ourselves on other things as well, like the gospel. So on the one hand, you're concerned that you'll get such pushback from voicing your opinion in one thing that you won't be able to voice your opinion well in another thing that's more important. But that presumes that the reason that they give you pushback on the political issues will not be the same reason they don't give you the same kind of pushback on theological issues. You're not going to get any more of a hearing from those people than you would on political issues. I mean, all things being equal. Now, of course, a huge thing that I advocate is that we be shrewd in the way we navigate. And if we're shrewd in the way we navigate, we can speak to these social political issues that have great moral consequence, and to spiritual issues as well that have great consequence as well, if we're shrewd. If we're not shrewd, we're going to get in trouble in both areas. That's the nature of the dialogue right now. It's hard in any area, okay? Another difficulty that we're facing, too, I remember years ago, and I remember who said this, a theologian. I can picture him right now. He's a decent man, but he gave a talk at ETS, Evangelical Theological Society, where a bunch of professionals were together listening, other theologians. And what he said is that there should not be a hint of politics in anything that we preach. We should be focusing on one thing and one thing only, and that's kingdom gospel stuff. Okay, well, I get his sentiment. The problem is, and it wasn't so true then, but I could see the handwriting on the wall, so to speak. The problem is that all the other side had to do was to declare some issue political, and according to the sentiment that was communicated by that theologian, we would have to get out of the discussion. All right? Oh, that's political. So we can't talk anymore. And we're sidelined in the discussion. Of course, what's happened is now everything is political. Every single thing is political. It is not possible to talk about anything of moral consequence right now without entering into the political environment. And so, of course, that's the difficulty of that point of view, is if your point of view is you can't talk on anything political, it's very easy for the other side to squeeze you completely out of the discussion, so you're irrelevant in culture. And then in what sense can we be salt and light? Well, we still can be, but I think in a much more limited sense. So we can't be the kind of salt and light that William Wilberforce was, who took on cultural issues for spiritual reasons and was aggressively political in order that justice was accomplished with regards to African slaves. And, of course, all that's political. And they told him to get out of politics, you know, quit forcing your religion on me kind of thing. So I guess so far, to sum up with regards to your question, Nathan, is that I don't think that these two categories can be easily isolated so that you can be silent in one in order to be able to get a hearing in another. The reason you're silent in one is because, or you're tempted to be silent in one area, is because of a tendency of the culture to bully on those issues, which that same group is going to bully you on the spiritual issues as well. And, I mean, this is kind of a figurative way of putting it, but the best way to deal with a bully is to knock them down. That is, to push back in legitimate ways so they stop bullying. And there are different ways that can be done in a culture. I don't mean physically knocking them down, although if you're talking about a physical bully, that's what you do. You stand up against them. You don't try to appease Hitler. You fight Hitler. He was a bully. They tried to appease him. It didn't work. So we have cultural bullies that are being appeased. It doesn't work. It just emboldens them. They taste blood and they go for more. So what we need to do is stand against them, but we have to do so in a principled way, in a way that's consistent with our values. And that's why when it comes to certain discussions like about socialism is a government system that trades on oppression. It gets into power because of claims regarding oppression, and it turns into the oppressor itself. And this is the way it's happened in every single place that it's been practiced. And so I think there are legitimate complaints against socialism. It increases poverty, where capitalism, as according to its record, has been great at dealing with poverty. Okay, I mean, it's not perfect, but who was it? Churchill said, it's the worst system on the planet, except for all the other systems. So you get a sense there. So I'm not going to encourage you to back down from those political issues necessarily. Because what that does is it gives an entire area of important discussion over to the other side. We are abandoning the field. And when we abandon the field, they take over. And when they take over one area, given the nature of the political left from the very beginning, from the Russian Revolution, it's totalitarian. And so when they take over one area, then they're going to take another and then another and then another, unless they're opposed. And when they get resistance, they don't know what to do except for scream and yell and call names and break things. So we can respond, I think, with principled arguments that can hold the day, at least for those who are willing to listen. And we do the same thing with regards to spiritual matters as well. And I think this is where the tactical game plan comes in, where we use questions to maneuver in both fields, in both areas. But we can't give up the field because bad things result for good people when we do, and that includes us. You know, have you heard the saying, you know, that first they came for this group, and we weren't that group, so we just let them do it. Then they came for another group, and we weren't that group, and then we didn't stand up. And then they came for us, and there was nobody left. Do you remember that saying, something to that effect?
Yeah, I do.
That was Martin Niemöller. Martin Niemöller was a Lutheran Christian under the Third Reich. And he said that because he ended up in Dachau. Now, he survived. Other Christian leaders did not. So what he's saying is, if we are silent with regards to justice, where other people are involved and we're not necessarily involved, then sooner or later that's going to come back to get us. And I think that is a dynamic that that is in place right now too, in many ways. So what you have to be is you have to pick your battles. You have to be shrewd. You have to, I think, ask the right questions. So if somebody's advancing socialism, ask them, tell me one place in the world that socialism has produced prosperity. Where? It hasn't. It's been destructive to economies. And this is why Europe, who has experimented with socialism for 50 years, is moving away from it. It just hasn't worked. It's created all kinds of problems. Anyway, that's the kind of thing. It's not my wheelhouse, all those academic cultural things, but if you want to talk about that issue, Jay Richards has written a great book called something like God, Money, and Capitalism. J. Wesley Richards of Privileged Planet fame. He also wrote a book on capitalism, and it's really, really good. I interviewed him 3 or 4 months ago, and we talked about his book. But it turns out that capitalism is the answer for the poor. Pardon me?
Oh, I remember your interview with him now that you mention it.
Yeah. So my point, though, is if you want to make a principled argument on regarding social economics on behalf of what is good for human beings, which means that it's a moral question, then socialism hasn't provided that answer, capitalism, with all of its flaws and difficulties, whatever it has, because it provides the most opportunity and the most liberty and also the most wealth.
Right.
For the most people, I guess I would add that too.
Okay.
Well, all right, Nathan?
Thanks for that, Greg.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate the call, all right?
All right, take care.
All right, buddy, take care. It's frustrating for me to, in a way, to deal with those kinds of questions. I'm glad Nathan called, obviously, because I realize that some things are more important than others. But what we don't always see is the interconnectedness of these things. I actually have been in, five or six communist countries before the wall came down. So in the mid-70s, I was in Yugoslavia, and I was in Hungary and Romania and Czechoslovakia and DDR, East Germany, and Poland and the Ukraine and Moldavia, in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union. And so I saw what that system did to people, especially Christians. Christians were not allowed to meet. And so they had to meet in private. They had to meet in secret and try not to get caught. And by the way, this has some ramifications for our circumstances right now. It was against the law for them to meet. And when they did get caught meeting, and they usually did it outdoors, Then they would be persecuted. People would be arrested. They would take their. I was with families whose children were taken away from them because they were teaching their children about Christ. So if you want to talk about oppression, that's oppression and Christian suffering. A lot of people talk about all oppression in the United States. They don't know what oppression is when real oppression happens. But I've seen it. I met a man who had all silver teeth. We had to go in the middle of the night in a small town, I'm trying to think of the name of it right now, in the Ukraine, in the former Soviet Union, to meet with a family whose husbands were in prison and whose children had been taken away from them. So we met with two women in a clandestine affair. In other words, we had to sneak in. And then another man showed up, and all of his teeth were silver. They were steel. The reason that all of his teeth were steel is because all of his real teeth had gotten beaten out of his head by the communists because he was a Christian. So there you go. Ideas have consequences, friends. And so therefore, arguing for political ideas or regarding political ideas that have such consequences turns out to be a partner concept to communicating the gospel. In my view, at least. Some people will take exception with that. I get it. But Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 2 that we ought to pray for our leaders so that we can live a peaceful life. And then right after that, he says, for God desires all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. So there's something related between leading a peaceful life of liberty and people coming to Christ because we have the freedom to communicate that. And so therefore, having people who fight for that freedom, rhetorically fight in Congress or politically, that is an aid to the gospel. All right, when we come back, I have a quote from Hugh Hewitt, and I'll see if I can find it and read it to you. But let's take a break right now. We'll come back here on Stand to Reason and get some more calls.
Did you know Stand to Reason has a YouTube channel? We release a new video each Monday on the topics you care about. Through short, engaging videos, our speakers train you on tactics, offer apologetics tips, answer common theology questions, and address big issues in the world today. Join tens of thousands of other subscribers so you can stay up to date when we release a new video. Just go to youtube.com and search STR Videos, all one word, and hit the subscribe button. That's STR Videos. Take advantage of this free resource to help you stay informed, encouraged, and equipped as you share your worldview with others.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible, and relevant content each week? As a nonprofit ministry, we rely on generous supporters in order to provide the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including apps, blog posts, articles, or short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. When you visit str.org/donate, you'll find a newly renovated transaction page that makes it easier than ever to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources over the past 25 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Please help us to continue on into the next 25 years by making a gift today at str.org/donate.
Well, I was scrambling around wildly here in my office the last 2 minutes looking for my copy of Hugh Hewitt's wonderful little book, In But Not Of, which is a primer that is he wrote 15 years ago, I guess now, to help Christians to have the greatest impact in the world that they possibly can. And each chapter is a little vignette of his personal advice. It's a great little book. And now I'm bugged because I can't find it. But I'm not too well organized here in my office at the moment. However, he does talk there in the beginning of the book about the preconditions that are necessary in a society for the gospel to freely go forth. And we need a cadre of trained, skilled, committed people, he argues, that can contend for the existence of those preconditions that only exist in a free society. And so he is a, well, he's done so many different things, radio talk show host for the last 20 years, syndicated with Salem, the Salem Network, but he's done all kinds of other things too. And his life is an example of accomplishing or working towards that same end. And so that is in the spirit of what I'm just describing right now. Now, by the way, that book is called In, But Not Of. Hugh Hewitt, H-E-W-I-T-T, is the author, and it's a fabulous book. I've gained tremendously from it. In fact, I cite it in the book on tactics because he has a chapter that's titled Ask at Least Half a Dozen Questions in Every Conversation, which is really at the heart of the Colombo tactic, and that's why I cite him. So I commend that book to you, but keep in mind the point as it relates to my call with Nathan just a few moments ago. All right, let's see, where are we at here? L.A., oh boy, Rick, you've been on for an hour and 17 minutes. Well, now you're on live, Rick. Thanks for your patience.
Hi, I have a couple questions for you and also a comment. I was listening to a couple of your YouTube videos, and I like your approach at asking questions and listening. My first question to you is, I would like to know, I heard you talking about atheists. And I would like to know what your definition of an atheist is.
Well, my definition of an atheist is the standard definition. It's one who believes there is no God. A is negative as a prefix. Theist or theism or theos is God. A God, no God. An atheist, classically, is someone who believes there is no God. It is not someone who has no belief about God or no belief in God. That way of stating their definition, I think, is self-serving, because even if an atheist say, I have no belief in God, well, that would be true, but that doesn't mean they have no belief about God. They do have a belief about God, and what they have, their belief about God is that he does not exist. And I'm not sure why don't they, well, I have my suspicions, but I think they ought to just own up to that fact rather than dancing around definitions like that.
Do you differentiate between somebody, the definition of what you said, and an atheist who believes there's not enough evidence to convince them that there's a God?
No, it's exactly the same. Because if a person says there is not enough evidence to convince me that there is a God, then I am not convinced that there is a God. If you are not convinced that there is a God, then your conviction is there is no God. And that's what an atheist is. That's not an agnostic.
You believe that it's only black or white. Do you believe that somebody can have, say, a 95% probability that there is no God and a 5% probability that there is a God?
Sure, somebody could have that kind of mix of confidence, but the question then becomes is, what is your conviction at this point? If it's 95 and 5, then their conviction is there is no God, but they could be mistaken. If they believe there is no God, they're an atheist. They're not an agnostic.
So even though go ahead.
Say again?
I was going to say, even though, so once they, if they believe more strongly that there is no God, or not even that there is God, they believe more strongly that they don't see the evidence for God, then that makes them an atheist in your definition of it.
Well, you're mixing up, conflating two different things. One is an epistemic question. And that is, what is the level of evidence for some idea? Okay. The other one, and that's the 95-5 that you talked about. Okay. Other one is the what is the personal conviction in light of the evidence? That's the other thing. Okay. What if I told you that I am 95% convinced there is a God and I have 5% uncertainty? What if I told you that? Would it be fair not to call me a theist? Well, Coco, you're not a theist. You're nothing. You're just in the middle because you're not 100% certain. Would that be fair?
Well, I'm not talking, for me, I don't look at it that way. I'm not talking in terms of fairness. So the question wasn't about fairness. So the question is your definition. So I don't look at it one way or the other. I don't.
No, wait. Okay, well, hold on just a second. Just to be clear, though, the question is not my definition, because words have meanings that are conventions in language held by people. And if all words' definitions were up to the individual, no one would be able to communicate. So, I mean, I'm not sure where you're going with this, Ryan, but I just want to be careful that we don't end up walking over a cliff on this kind of thing. Okay, let me try to put it in a little different way. And I'm not trying to be unfair to agnostics or atheists or theists here. I'm just trying to speak plain English. Let me put it this way. If there is a person, let me back up. I'm going to make a statement, okay? And then I'm going to suggest possible responses to the statement. And the statement is, God exists. Now, there are only three possible postures any individual can have with regards to that statement. They could either agree that they think it's true. Now, I'm not talking about whether they know it's true. I'm talking about what they believe. They believe it's true, even if they don't know it. So they can affirm it. Yes, God exists. They could deny it. No, God does not exist. I don't agree with that statement. Or they could say, I'm withholding. I can't say I or nay because I don't know one way or another. Let's leave the word no out. I have no belief one way or another. I don't affirm God doesn't exist. I don't affirm he does exist. I need more information to be able to form my own belief on this. So those are the only three logical possibilities. Notice that 95.5 hasn't come into the discussion here. It's irrelevant. It has to do with what a person's convictions are. In my case, regardless of whatever my proportion of confidence happens to be, I think the statement is true. That is my belief. That is my conviction. Therefore, I'm a theist. If someone says regarding the statement, God exists, they think that that's a false statement for whatever reason, then they're an atheist. If they can't say one way or another, if they have no conviction whether God exists or not, then they're an agnostic. That's what these words mean. Now, a lot of atheists, people who are in fact atheists, have tried to go the so-called agnostic route, saying they have no belief in God, even though they don't know for sure. And then they write a book on their non-belief. You don't write books or articles or do talk shows on non-beliefs. You write books about what you believe to be the case. And in this case, they believe that there is no God. And that's why they're called atheists.
Now, would you differentiate between somebody who believes in a God but doesn't believe in a Christian God?
Sure. That would also be a type of theist. That would not be a Christian theist. That would be a theist.
Okay. And then my last question is regarding your approach. So I believe what you said is your approach is to, when you ask questions and have a dialogue with somebody, is to put a pebble in their shoe to, I'm gonna kind of put words in your mouth, and you can correct me if this is
sure.
How it fit. Basically convince them that Christianity is true.
If I'm putting a pebble in their shoe, I'm not necessarily trying to convince them, looking for their mind to be changed at that moment. I want them to eventually become convinced that Christianity is true, but what I'm doing in the moment is just giving them something to think about in that direction. So they may be persuaded or not, but my goal is just to get them thinking. That's why I say I'm putting a pebble in their shoe. I'm just giving them something to think about because I think Christianity and Jesus in particular are worth thinking about. But I don't know where they're going to take it or what God is going to do with that. So I'm lowering the bar, not trying to do the big thing, which is win them to Christ, convince them in that moment that Christianity is true. I'm lowering the bar for myself. I'm trying to do some small things, which I call gardening, that could have a salutary impact in their life in moving them closer to the conviction that Christianity is true.
Okay.
That's what I have in mind with putting a stone in their shoe.
And are you open to the opposite? Somebody doing that to you to show you that Christianity potentially wouldn't be true?
It happens all the time. And by the way, whether I'm open to it or not is irrelevant. Putting a stone in someone's shoe is what the other person does. You don't have to be open to it. I mean, you don't, it isn't like, okay, now I'm open, I'm going to receive it. If I'm trying to persuade you of something, I'm going to offer this information for you. Now, whether you think about it or not, that's up to you, okay? Whether you consider it or not, that's up to you. But hopefully the idea will be cogent enough that you give it some real consideration. You, I'm thinking metaphorically here, you or whoever I'm talking to. And maybe it is you in this situation because I don't know your personal convictions. But if somebody gives me a challenge, well, I'm certainly going to think about it. Partly I'm going to think about it for my own sake. Partly I'm going to think about it because I it's helpful if I can think out loud on behalf of other people, like other Christians who are faced with the same conflict. And then I'll explain why I think this doesn't work. Like, for example, when somebody says, well, I'm not an atheist. I don't believe it. I'm not saying God doesn't exist because I don't know. I'm just saying that I have no belief in God or that whatever. Well, I thought about that, and that's just a dodge. And so that's why I talk about it. So I'm giving those things consideration. There's no problem there. But they haven't created a problem for me in the sense that most of them, a real stone, some cases they have, but most of the time they aren't troublesome to me because I know how to resolve the apparent problem that was raised or the challenge.
And would there be anything that could ever happen that would convince you that Christianity was not true?
I'm sorry, say that again, because things are a little bit muffled.
Would there be any evidence or anything that could potentially happen that would convince you that Christianity was not true?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of things. In principle, at least, if someone could demonstrate that it was unreasonable to believe that God existed, then that would mean Christianity would be false, because the Christian story says, in the beginning, God. If somebody could show that morality, objective morality, did not exist, that it was simply a subjective invention, well, that would mean there could be no evil in the objective sense, and therefore there could be no sin. And if there's no sin, there's no need for a savior. And then, of course, then Christianity's out of play too, because a vital element of the worldview that makes it work is missing. If Jesus did not exist, or it turns out that Jesus was not the person that the New Testament documents proclaim him to be or present him to be, well, then Christianity would be false. If it turns out that there is no soul, then Christianity would be false. If it turned out that Jesus did not rise from the dead, then Christianity would be false. There are lots of ways to demonstrate that Christianity is false. It's defeasible. In other words, it's possible to show the belief is false, at least in principle. But because it's defeasible, because it's falsifiable, that means it's also possible to garner evidence in favor of Christianity as well, which I think is a strength, actually.
Okay, that was it. Appreciate the answers.
Okay, Ryan, appreciate. Oh, wait a minute. Am I not talking to Ryan? Who am I talking to? I'm talking to Rick. Rick. Okay, I don't want to push the wrong button here. All right, Rick, thank you for the call, and well played. And it was a lot of fun for me to chat with you. So do we have a break coming up? Nod, no, yes, no, maybe so. Okay, well, let's go to Ryan. Ryan in Cincinnati, and these buttons are really weird for me, so I got to make sure I don't, you know, make someone go away that's been on for an hour and 26 minutes. Ryan, are you there, brother?
Brian, yes, I am, with a B.
Oh, Brian, okay.
Yes,
gotcha.
Sir.
All right,
so
Brian with a B in Cincinnati. Glad to hear from you.
Thank you so much for taking my call and for the years of your unwittingly discipling me over a distance. So.
Oh, well, you're welcome. And it is unwitting because I didn't know I was doing it, but I'm glad to hear that I have been.
Exactly. So for the sake of time, I don't know how much information you want, but basically, I've been mulling over an idea that someone who formerly went to my church has put before me, and the idea is the sacred name movement. And she subscribes to this movement, and it normally wouldn't give me pause except for 2 points, and I'd like to get your opinion on both of those points.
Okay.
Okay, so first of all, probably the more important one is there any legitimacy at all to this movement based on the idea that when we as Christians have to, doctrinally, we have to subscribe to, in order to identify the God that we believe in, we have to, accept Trinitarianism. There's a host of things that we actually believe that help to identify our God versus the other gods that are offered, in society or whatever. So is the name, because I thought about it, if God is that particular about his identity, it's at least within the realm of possibility that it could be that we have to pronounce his name correctly, or we could be addressing or appealing to the wrong God. So that's the first point. And then the second
okay,
one.
Okay, let me just deal with that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Bri, are you listening, Bri?
Yep. Yes, sir.
Wait, I said Bri. Do you understand who I'm talking to when I say Bri?
Yes.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter whether I say Bri or Brian.
No, it doesn't.
Or Brian Boy.
No, it doesn't
matter. You know I'm talking to you, and everybody else knows I'm referring to you.
Right, and that's my...
I mean, this takes us back to Shakespeare. What's in a name? A rose by any other name smell is sweet. I mean, I think this is silly.
Right, I think
I honestly do. It's silly. And if someone is going to argue, as to your first question, if there's any legitimacy to the idea that doctrinally we have to say the right name and say it, in other words, the sound has to come out of our mouth just right.
Right.
For us to be worshiping the appropriate God. There's nothing in Scripture that says such a thing, suggests such a thing, and it just, on the face of it, sounds silly. That's why I could say, hey, Bri, bro. I could call you, and there's all kinds of nicknames I could have for you, okay?
Right.
Jesus was called Lord. That was his common title. They referred to him as Lord. We call him Jesus in English, but in different languages, they have different... In Spanish, it's Jesus. Are all the Spanish-speaking people out of luck because they don't say the English version?
Well, I don't think so, no.
Right.
But,
well, what I'm not chastising you, Bri, but what I am trying to show is how ludicrous this suggestion is. Now, I'm not going to condescend in a person who's trying to say that, because I'm not talking to your friend right now. I'd be trying to explain it. But what, I mean, I'm standing apart from her now, and I'm saying, God, do you realize how silly this sounds? There's only one word. Pardon me?
The interesting thing about it is this person goes under a different name than her given name anyway, so it's very interesting that she should.
Oh, my goodness.
And I address
That's
her
crazy.
Under the... Right.
Yeah, now, that is so ironic, By the way, there is only, as far as I know, there is only one word that is the same word in it's got the same sound in every single language.
Okay.
And that word is hallelujah. Hallelujah. Because it's transliterated, it's like Hebrew kind of phrase or whatever, and it's transliterated. They just say the same thing, hallelujah, hallelujah. Now, they might say it with a little different accent in different places, but it's the same. All the rest of the words are translated or transliterated with some phonetic differences in different languages. So there are thousands of people with thousands of different languages that maybe say the word Jesus a little different.
Right.
And maybe they say Yeshua or Joshua. Or maybe they say Yesu or Jesus or whatever. But just because their phonetics are different, why would that make a difference in the one that we're addressing, for goodness sake?
Well, the only reason that it gave me pause is, like I said, because of the breadth of or scope of things that we need to... To be considered a Christian, there's a whole host of things that we need to adhere to as far as the identity is concerned. And
sure.
So for example, I had heard, I was listening to your podcast from the other day, a guy was talking about the verse in the Bible that says, if you believe in your heart that Christ has been raised from the dead, and then you'll be saved. And so the LDS believe that, you know what I mean? But I realize what the problems with their I mean, this is where we get into the finer points of the identity.
Well, keep
of,
in mind, by the way, in that verse in Romans 10, it says more than that. If you confess with your mouth Jesus as Lord and believe in your heart God raised him from the dead, then you'll be saved. And Jesus is Lord means that he's God.
Right.
And so Jehovah's Witnesses don't agree with that. So they
I said LDS.
Oh, LDS. Well, they don't think Jesus is God either, not in the sense that the New Testament teaches.
Right, and that's where
he's a created being.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Jesus is a created being. Yeah. So you're right that there are very particular things that we need to believe to be within the pale of Orthodox Christianity, and that these things that we believe are communicated by particular words that mean specific things.
Right.
My point is the pronunciation of the word doesn't change the meaning of the word. And that's what this movement seems to suggest. If you don't pronounce the word right, then you're not getting the right Jesus. Nonsense to me. But go ahead.
Actually, they say that you need to say Yeshua versus Jesus because in the translation, the meaning is lost to them. But we may be. I don't want to use up too much of your time. So
no, you're okay. I got one more caller coming on in Wisconsin, and we still got 15 minutes, so there's time for this. But I just, how is it that if what your friend says is true, then a person who speaks English with an accent destroys the meanings of the word she's saying or he's saying?
Well, maybe.
People who are German say, Voda, give me a glass of Voda, you know, because they say their W's like V's. Does that mean we don't understand that he means water and we're going to give him some water?
Right, but the difference between Yeshua and Jesus is a different type of, I mean, it would be the equivalent, I think, of instead of the whatever the German word for water is, they were asking for that versus then saying Voda or whatever, which is an attempt to speak the English word.
Yeah, well, Voda is the German word for water, and in English they might say Water, but they'd use the W pronunciation like a V. It's utterly inconsequential. It's just if I said I'm praying to Yeshua or I'm praying to Jesus, in language there are a thing called tokens and types, okay?
There we go. That's what I needed to hear.
Okay, so I'm sitting on a chair. The chair, that's English word, okay?
Right.
If it was Cambodian, I'd say gao ai. Okay, that is a different token to point to the same type, a different token pointing to the same type. The tokens are conventional. They change with languages, but the type is the same thing because we're referring to the same thing. So if I'm saying Jesus or Yeshu or Yeshua or Yeshua HaMashiach, I am still making reference to the exact same individual under different titles or under different reference or tokens. That's all it is.
And I agree with you. I agree with you. I wanted to figure out a way that I could explain that in the way that you just did. So my final part of this is it a formal heresy, what she's believing? Because I can see in one way that it is, but in another way she believes the same things that I do. She just has, it almost sounds like a works-based addition to the,
I would say, no, it's not a formal heresy. It's not even an informal heresy. It's just kind of nonsense.
Okay.
It's foolishness. And I don't mean to simply be disparaging the individual. I think this particular point is foolishness. It's nonsense. Okay. It's straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel. It's the kind of thing that Paul said we shouldn't do when we argue about inconsequentials. This is an inconsequential. And one of the simplest way to make the point is the way that I tried to make the point to you right out of the gate by calling you Bri. You didn't think I was referring to a different caller. You knew who I was talking about.
Right.
My mom's name was Elizabeth. They called her Betty. They called her Liz. There's actually a whole bunch of variations of Elizabeth. But they were all the same person. They were referring to the same individual. It's like the morning star and the evening star. Hesperus and I can't remember the other one. But they're all the same star. It's still Venus, even if you use different names to describe it. It doesn't mean the referent is still the same. Okay?
Yes. Okay.
Make
sense? Thank you very much.
Okay. Good talking to you, Brian. I'm glad I was able to hopefully make some sense out of this. Let me go to a commercial really quickly. I think that's next, and then we'll go to Kat in Wisconsin in just a moment on Stand to Reason.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks. Well, I have a cocoa happy moment right now, and I'm glad I've got happy music to go along with it, because I found my copy of In But Not Of, and I want to read to you the first words of the book, which are the first two paragraphs of the preface. Remember, this is Hugh Hewitt, and this has to do with the point I was making earlier about the, in a certain sense, the social-political battle turns out to have spiritual ramifications, and that's why it's important, okay? And here's what he says. His opening salvo, if it's true, as Jesus says it is, that he is the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father except through me, John 14:6, then salvation, happiness for infinity, depends upon the ability of individuals to hear the gospel. The effective and mass communication of the gospel depends upon the freedom to proclaim it. Though it's possible to proclaim the gospel in the face of persecution, obviously, the unfettered freedom to do so is much, much more to be preferred. There are billions of souls who are up for eternal grabs, so the unfettered ability to reach them with the good news is a great and wonderful thing, hard to create and difficult to defend. The creation and defense of religious liberty requires men and women with power and influence in the world. Wow. Well said, Hugh. Makes my point. All right. Let's go to the faithful and patient Kat in Wisconsin. Hello, Kat.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's really great to talk to you. We've been supporters of your ministry for a couple of years. I stumbled across you probably 4 years completely randomly. And you've been a humongous blessing in my life and in my husband's lives and hopefully my kids' lives.
Well, thank you so much. And this is the first time anybody said I was a humongous blessing. So that's a unique one, and I appreciate that. By the way, where in Wisconsin are you?
I'm in Hudson, which is just across the river from St. Paul, Minnesota, right off 94.
Oh, okay. Right. Well, I just drove through there a couple of weeks, about a month ago, actually, right through that area on my way to our place in northern Wisconsin. So, yep, Wisconsin's one of my most favorite places. Hope to be there.
Yeah, it's turning out to be one of mine, too. I moved here when my husband and I got married. So I'm originally from Iowa, but I'm liking it
gotcha.
Here anyway.
All right. Good folks there. So what's on your mind, Kat?
So my grandfather is in failing health. He's really old, so this is not a surprise. I mean, obviously it's sad, but my mom and I are both Christians. The rest mm-hmm. of my family is what I'd call like a cultural Christian. They go to church like once in a while, and it's not like the ruling thing in their life. He himself calls himself a Christian. He's been a very works-based person, giving money to all sorts of charity and things like that. But there is, I don't mean to be disparaging of him, but there's really no visible Christian fruit in his life.
Okay.
And so naturally we're worried about his salvation as he gets closer to the end.
Sure.
But every time my mom, I guess one of my aunts is also a Christian, every time they've tried to talk with him about salvation and where he is with things, he shuts the conversation down. He changes the subject entirely, or he just says, well, I read my Bible when I was a kid and I'm fine. And I've made my peace with God. And he's not really entertaining questions. I'm the granddaughter, and he's definitely not going to take that from me. He's not that kind of person. So I'm mostly asking for my mom, like, if you have any thoughts on how to just get the gospel out there to him as he gets closer to the end, because we don't think it's going to be super long.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a challenging situation because you have someone who is inoculated, it appears, to Christianity. That is, they have, and I could be wrong about this, but that is, they have enough of a taste of it to be resistant to the real thing. That's what inoculations do. And there are, say again? Oh, okay. And there are massive numbers of people in Christendom at large that are just like that. And, for example, I mean, to say, well, I read my Bible at 7. Did you have a meal when you were 7? Yes. Well, does that mean you don't have to eat again for the rest of your life? You know, God's words are truth for a daily bread, right? But even, I mean, I'm talking with you about that and make that comment. It makes sense to you, but this does not sound like it will make sense to your grandfather because he's not interested in hearing it. And he's really resistant. I don't know what it is that he is resistant of. There's only a couple of things that come to mind, and they don't strike me as excessively helpful in your circumstance, but they might be factors that will lead you to something else. When you visit your grandfather, you might say, and so does your mom, you might ask him or just pray for him. We're going to pray, Dad or Grandpa. We're going to pray before we leave. We're going to leave now, so we're going to pray. Give me your hand. Now, I don't know how he would respond to that. Most people, unless they're really cantankerous, will not deny prayer. Even partly, maybe it's just because it seems too impolite to say no. And then if you can pray for him, then just pray a very real, genuine prayer. In other words, pray something from your heart that shows intimacy with God, and I'm sure as a Christian you're fully capable of that, or your mom is, but you want to be subversive in your prayer. So you want to pray the truth of God's word while you're praying. And so it might be something like, Lord, thank you for taking care of Grandpa. We really love him, and we want your hand to be upon him. And we thank you that there is always mercy through your son, that no matter what happens, that we can trust, as we put our trust in your son, there is complete and perfect mercy and forgiveness because what Jesus did for us. Thank you for that great gift. So, in other words, you're not, in a sense, preaching at him, and you're not praying about him in his presence. Sometimes there's a place for that, but here you're not doing that. You're not saying, please save Grandpa. He's so grumpy and he's so resistant. Open his heart, you know. No, rather, you're just going to pray for him and the circumstances in a gracious way, but make the content of your prayer theologically significant, and that contains a robust statement about the grace of God through Jesus. It doesn't have to be long to be robust, but something that states it clearly. That, you know, that we know there's nothing that we can do, that every time we do something, we fall short. But we know that you forgive us and for Jesus' sake, and we're thankful for that, and that we have confidence to be in your presence one day because of what Jesus has done for us. Yeah, something like that. So I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of grasping here a little bit for ideas, but that's what's left for you, really, or your mom, when you have a loved one who's resistant. I don't want to hear about that kind of stuff if you're preaching at them. But if you're praying for them as you leave, well, there's kind of propriety to that. Okay, we're going to go, we're going to pray. And then just make that a habit of praying before you leave every time. And, you know, God might use that and have that truth sink in a profound way.
That's really helpful. I had not thought about that myself.
All I got right now, you know, and you said that he doesn't respond to questions, and maybe as things get closer to death, he might be more responsive. When my dad became a, my dad was a, oh, we're out of time, aren't we? I'm looking at the clock. Even my board operator is so lost in this discussion that he didn't realize to push the button. We're out of time. But my dad became a Christian, you know, just a year and a half before he died, when he had a real serious operation. And sometimes that has a way of getting people's attention. Got to run, Kat from Wisconsin. Thank you so much for your call. And keep me posted. Let me know if something ever comes of that suggestion that I offer. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. You give him heaven this week.